KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
You listen, if you listen and learn, then you're going to be able to do anything you want next time.
Everybody thinks show business is really, really all right life. Peaches and cream.
What's with him?
Oh, I'm afraid he's gone Hollywood.
This week on The Business, from Paranormal Activity to Insidious Chapter 2, producer Jason Blum knows how to make hit horror movies for a price. Efficiency is his obsession, and that extends to having a mobile office in a souped-up van.
Driving, particularly in Los Angeles, makes your workday incredibly inefficient. So now I have my office in my van.
But first, on the Hollywood News Banter, China's ambitious plans to become the center of the film universe. Stick around, it's The Business from KCRW.
You can imagine Hollywood, everything is really driven by
making money.
What's with him?
I'm joined by my partner in banter, John Horn of Los Angeles Times. Hello, John.
Hello, Kim.
So, John, big news out of China, maybe. It seems like big news. The wealthiest man in China, Wang Jianlin, who is chairman of the Dalian Wanda Group, and this is a company that's been expanding its interest in the entertainment world rapidly, had a splashy press conference on the 22nd of September, attended by some Hollywood royalty and some Hollywood not-so-much royalty. He's announcing a gigantic development up to $8.2 billion worth, encompassing film studios, resort hotels, a huge amusement park. And to unveil this hugely ambitious project in the city of Qingdao, he had an array of stars, Nicole Kidman, John Travolta, Leonardo DiCaprio, as well as some Chinese stars, and Harvey Weinstein, representatives of the top agencies. What are we to make of this news?
We're looking for people, first of all, who will take a huge appearance fee and fly on a private jet over to China. I talked to somebody who does extensive business in China. By his estimate, and certainly the agencies are not going to confirm this, these stars earned as much as $500,000 per person to appear in China on top of flying privately. It was probably $1 million in some cases to get these people there. And you would think Leonardo DiCaprio, who's been a big advocate for the environment, would not patronize a country that has such a horrible record in terms of pollution. But I'll set that aside for now. The big play, I think, is Wanda's expansion into media and entertainment. They bought AMC Theaters for $2.6 billion. They gave the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences a $20 million gift that will go toward its new museum. But I'm not sure how much we are to believe that any of this will ever really see the light of day. Somebody else I talked to in China said that a movie studio is a good way to make a land grab. Obviously, it's a communist country, but if you're going to develop land for a movie studio, you somehow get preferential treatment. And certainly Wanda has been very successful so far in developing real estate across its country. It's done huge amounts of work in theater exhibition. So I'm not sure what to make of this, but it sure is a lot of money.
It is. And there, of course, one of the questions is, are all these agents and stars running over to China to help China, you know, surpass the American market? This Mr. Wang has estimated that, he says it is estimated that China film box office revenue will surpass North America by 2018 and double it by 2023. So, of course, is that something that Hollywood wants to assist? But I do think probably you're right, and there's a certain amount of skepticism that all of this will truly come to pass. And meanwhile, Hollywood is really hungry for money. This guy clearly has it. China has it. Everybody's been trying to get their hands into the Chinese till. So even if they're making Chinese films for Chinese audiences and helping with expertise, the smell of money is definitely in the nostrils of Hollywood.
Yeah, and I think even if you're looking in terms of co-productions where American studios or actors would come over and make movies there, there's a huge amount of available and largely unoccupied sound stages in China right now. And if you're a top A-list actor like Leonardo DiCaprio or Nicole Kidman, are you really going to move to China for 3 months to make a movie there? And we've talked a lot about runaway production, but it's one thing to go to Louisiana or Michigan. It's another thing to go to China for 3 months. And a lot of these studios are far outside the major cities. Benefit being maybe the air is a little bit better, but not a lot going on there. So I think that is a huge question mark in terms of whether or not this is going to pay out for American companies moving over there.
But this is supposed to be a particularly lovely area, a very nice climate located between Beijing and Shanghai. So if, in fact, that all of these resort hotels and shopping malls, et cetera, are built, including a yacht club, which is planned, and apartment towers, maybe this will become some kind of destination. But I have to agree that a great deal remains to be seen with this very ambitious plan. One thing we know is this guy definitely has the money. He's worth an estimated $14 billion. But let me turn to Runaway Production, which you mentioned, John. L.A. Mayor Eric Garcetti said on his first day of office that it's a state of emergency, the degree to which California is losing production jobs and the money that flows to not just, you know, people who work on films and television, but other ancillary businesses, dry cleaners, car companies, etc. So he had vowed to appoint a czar of film, and he has now made good on that promise.
Yeah, he's picked former Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences President Tom Sherrick, who has a long history at 20th Century Fox, started at Paramount, was a partner at Revolution Studios. And Sherrick's job is pretty simple. He has to persuade state legislators to increase their rebate financing. Right now, it's $100 million, which is a fraction of what states like New York, which has more than $400 million in incentives, offer right now. And it's very understandable why a lot of TV shows and a lot of film productions leave the state. It's cheaper to film in other U.S. states and often cheaper to film in other countries. So his obligation and duty is going to try to increase funding for in-state incentives. The real issue is there's a lot of resistance, especially among Republicans, that see these kinds of deals as favoring rich people like Tom Cruise or Will Smith or George Clooney. So it's going to be a very political fight. But as you said, there are a lot of jobs at stake.
Yeah, and Tom Sherrick is an old Hollywood hand with a lot of horse trading experience, especially in distribution, where you have to kind of work things out with theater owners and decide what trailer is getting played where and who's getting what percentage of the money. So in that sense, he may be very well prepared for a political job, a job that involves persuasion. On the other hand, he's been unwell. He's fighting prostate cancer. He's talked in the media about his chemo. He says he's strong enough. He thinks his head is clear. He's fine in that respect. His ability to travel might be another issue. So he's going to need, you know, good luck both with the job and with his own personal battle.
There are very few executives in Hollywood who are as well-connected as Tom Sherrick. So I'd have to say, based on connections alone, Garcetti made a very smart pick.
Thank you, John.
Thank you, Kim.
That's John Horn of the Los Angeles Times. You can keep up with us on Twitter. My handle is at Kim Masters. John's is at JG Horn. And our producer, Darby Maloney's, is at Darby KCRW. Up next, producer Jason Blum on his formula for making low-cost genre movies that score at the box office. While the big studios are doing a post-mortem on a summer that led to a lot of expensive misses, producer Jason Blum has figured out how to make hit horror movies on the cheap. Blum got his start working on Acquisitions at Miramax, and it was the movie he didn't get, the 1999 found footage horror blockbuster Blair Witch Project, that made him vow he wouldn't make the same mistake twice. So when a little picture called Paranormal Activity went up for sale, he pounced. That film, made for a mere $15,000 by Oren Peli, went on to gross more than $193 million worldwide. And it gave Blum a business model that he could replicate. Since then, he's made four more paranormals, with a fifth on the way, and another one in the works with a Hispanic cast. This year, Blum has released the sci-fi thriller The Purge, starring his good friend Ethan Hawke, that had a $3 million production budget and has grossed over $86 million worldwide. And Blum produced Insidious Chapter 2, the second installment from director James Wan, now in theaters. Made for $5 million, that film has already brought in more than $70 million. Jason Blum has a production deal with Universal to finance and market many of his films, but he still watches every penny. When he recently spoke with the business contributor John Horn, he revealed that he takes his obsession with efficiency with him on the road.
Let's talk about your van. Some people drive hybrids. Some people take motorcycles.
I have a Chevy Astro, yes.
And why is your van so special to you?
Well, I hate driving. I'm a terrible driver. And I find driving, particularly in Los Angeles, makes your workday incredibly inefficient. So now I have my office in my van. We took a Chevy Astra. We gutted the back. So I have a computer. I have high-speed internet, my call sheet, and my email. And I have a trusty production assistant named Ben who drives me around. And I don't lose any time looking at my GPS, running red lights, getting into accidents, and we have a printer in it. It's a great thing.
Meaning you are able to look at dailies, you're able to read scripts, you're able to stay on top of what you've got going in the day and not have that wasted time?
I do that too. It's really like my office. So when it's after hours, I'll look at dailies, I'll look at movies, and I'll read scripts or the newspaper. But during the workday, it's exactly like my office. So I have my computer and my call sheet and I'm on the phone with my office. So I'm really like, it's like I moved my office into a car. But the efficiency stuff is, I save about 2 hours a day, I would say, by not ever getting lost, not ever dealing with directions, not ever getting frustrated with traffic, not ever having to go into a garage to lose a signal, all of those things. Never waiting for valet parking. Like, it's a great thing for efficiency. I'm big on efficiency.
Do you have meetings in there? Will somebody come in?
We designed it to have meetings. We designed it to have four people, but it's way too creepy. So that was the idea, is I could actually have meetings in there. It's too small for meetings. I have to graduate to Mercedes makes a thing called a sprinter van, which is really like kind of like almost like a small plane. It's huge. I would never drive one of those, but those are the kind of vans that you can have meetings in.
Let's talk about, you mentioned creepy, you mentioned efficiency. Let's talk about how those two things come together. I want to talk about the financial model that you apply to your genre films and what are the key decisions that you have to make. And if a filmmaker comes to you and says, Jason, I really want to do this movie, but I need like $500,000 more. How do you tell him, because I don't think you're making a lot of movies with women right now, how do you tell him that a million means a million?
It's a constant challenge, but the model doesn't work unless we're very disciplined about it. Most production companies chase good stories, whatever kind they are, and we only chase good stories that we can do inexpensively. One of the harder things is when someone comes in and pitches what I would think is the greatest idea ever or a big tentpole, hot potential franchise kind of movie, and we have to have the discipline to say, as great as I think that is, you should talk to my partners at Universal, but that's just not for me. The $500,000 question is slightly easier than that. Our filmmakers know going in exactly what the parameters are. They have pretty much total creative freedom in exchange for working for a low budget. So the minute the budget goes up, the freedom comes away. Sometimes it's not always easy. Sometimes we struggle when we get down to the nitty-gritty of it because the director has to sign off on our budget. But they know the deal going in.
I want to talk about some of the directors you've worked with. Let's talk about James Wan, who directed Insidious Chapter 2 and the original Insidious. When you first made the original Insidious, a movie that cost initially less than $1 million, James was coming off two big studio flops, Death Sentence and Dead Silence, $20 million movies that didn't really work. A lot of the town would look at somebody like that and say, damaged goods, director jail, don't want to work with him. You look at somebody like James and see something very different. What do you see in a director like James?
We see a director who did Saw, who's, you know, one of the biggest scary movie hits of all time, and did Saw on a low budget, totally on his own. I think one of the trickier things about Hollywood is that directors go from having a great movie at Sundance, bang into a $30 million studio movie, which is an extraordinarily hard transition. And that's what happened to James. And when very young directors go into that situation, they don't have a lot of control, which they're right not to have. You don't just give someone who's 26 years old $30 million, or very rarely, or 50 or 80 or whatever the movie's cost. So a lot of different things can go wrong. So we look at the Saw did not come out of thin air. You know, it came out of James and Lee's mind. And we say to James, look, we want you to go back to your roots. We're not going to give you a lot of money, but we're going to let you do what you want to do. And I'll tell you an interesting story kind of more specifically about that and how the low budget model works. When James first pitched Insidious to us, or after we read it, he came to talk about it, and he said, you know, I want the third act of this movie to be a David Lynch movie. If you were doing that for $20 million, you'd have to say, it can't. You know, David Lynch, that's not commercial enough. I don't know what you mean, surreal, dreamy, like this is supposed to be a popcorn scary movie. But when you do movies inexpensively, I said, great.
Meaning that with more money comes more controls, more approvals, and that the studio is going to have an opinion about something like a David Lynch segment, and then your whatever the movie is that James wants to make is not going to be the movie he ends up making.
Definitely, definitely. I think there's an inverse relationship, rightly so, that's how the system works, between creative control and budget. So the higher the budget, the less creative control you have, which makes perfect sense. And that's the big conversation I have with directors coming into the office, is they always think a bigger budget means a better movie, but it doesn't. A bigger budget means they have to compromise more.
sometimes a director will come in and he might have a movie that is too expensive. In other words, it's more of a Universal movie. Does the opposite ever happen, that somebody comes to Universal and they have a genre movie and Universal sends that director your way?
Yeah, all the time. All the time. And I encourage them to do that. And it can be an idea. I use this example of The Purge. If I was working at Universal and you pitched me The Purge as a $20 million movie and I was an executive at Universal, I would say, get out of my office. I'd say, you want me to give you $20 million to make a movie about where crime is legal for 12 hours a year? Like it could be great, but there's so many ways that concept could go wrong. Insane. I would definitely have said no. But when you make that movie for $3 million, it's like, nothing can go so horribly wrong. You know, it's a great VOD title. Like, there's definitely some value in it, and it could be great. And so I have a great dialogue with Universal, and we talk about scripts all the time. And in fact, we're doing a movie with J-Lo, which is our erotic thriller, which we start in 3 or 4 weeks, which was a movie called Boy Next Door. And that was a movie that they were kind of flirting with, but it's kind of like an erotic thriller, like those, you know, I would have done the exact same thing they did. Like, it doesn't make sense at $20 million. So it does happen a lot.
I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business from KCRW. John Horn is talking with Jason Blum, the producer of low-budget genre movies The Purge and Insidious Chapter 2. Blum has an amazing track record at the box office, but one key to that success is he knows that not every movie should be released in theaters.
So when we sit with a director and they come in and they say, I want a guaranteed release commitment, I always say, you're in the wrong office. There are a lot of advantages of low-budget movies besides creative freedom. Another advantage is we don't have to go wide with the movies. No one has a perfect track record, maybe, except for Steven Spielberg, but really nobody does. And the way that we insure against that is we keep the budgets low, and by keeping the budgets low, we don't have to go wide with the movies. So we don't have to spend $30 million in P&A if we miss the mark. And I say to the directors right off the bat, it's bet on yourself, Lynn. If we go and we screen this movie in front of an audience and if it's clearly a miss, then we don't pretend it isn't.
So if you have to have a conversation with, like, Joe Johnson and Not Safe for Work, a movie that you made that maybe didn't turn out as well as you'd hoped, how is that conversation? Does the director know it's going to happen?
We're transparent about our business. So Joe, who I had a terrific experience with and who got the model completely and came in on budget, and we tried something slightly different. It wasn't a pure horror movie. It was an office thriller, and it was made very, very inexpensively. And exactly what I described happened. We screened the film for an audience. Joe and I didn't have a disagreement about it. It was pretty clear that the movie wasn't right for a 3,000 screen release, but it's right for a smaller release. And luckily, with VOD growing, one of the things I say to the directors is, unlike a pilot, it's on iTunes, it's on Netflix, your friends can see it. And also, no one loses a lot of money on the movie, which isn't good for anybody.
If I'm a studio executive who's used to making $80, $100 million movies and I visit one of your sets, what are the things that I'm going to notice are very different from a typical studio film?
Well, the obvious things are not there. We don't have trailers. We don't have a lot of trucks. The crew is much smaller. The craft service is bad. You know, there's peanut butter and jelly and a couple of oranges. But the filmmaking process is very much the same. The DP, the production designer, the AD, the producers, the director were all people you'll recognize because most of those people have done a lot of big budget movies or expensive television shows. So it feels more the same than different, except the scale of it is much smaller.
Have you always loved horror, or is it something you came to love while you were working in acquisitions for Bob and Harvey Weinstein, or was it Paranormal Activity? When did your love affair with horror begin?
I've always loved movies. I've loved all kinds of movies. My affair with horror particularly began with Paranormal Activity, which gave birth to this model. And what I love is, which kind of sounds like a strange thing to say, but I love my business model because it's unusual and it's different and it's new. And I love horror because it fits into that. But I really love movie bands. I'm not like, you know, Eli or Quentin, who are like horror gurus like that. I'm lucky enough to work with those people. Like, James Wan is like that. Scott Derrickson is like that. And I've learned an enormous amount about horror from those people. But I'm certainly late to the party, unlike them.
After a short break, how Jason Blum convinces cast and crew to get on board with his low-budget model. To make a comment about today's show, go to kcrw.com/thebusiness.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. The Business contributor, John Horn, is talking with producer Jason Blum, who's carved out a niche in low-budget horror. His latest film is Insidious Chapter 2, starring Rose Byrne and Patrick Wilson as a couple who find that they've got supernatural company in the family home.
Still happening.
What is?
I heard the piano playing by itself downstairs, and I found Callie on the floor of her room by her crib.
Well, maybe she climbed out of her crib. Has she ever done that before?
What? What is wrong with you?
Renee, I just want us to move on from this. That's all. I want us to be a normal family again.
There is nothing normal about this, okay? These things are still here.
Insidious Chapter 2, like the 2010 original, was directed by James Wan, just the kind of enterprising and budget-minded director who makes up a key ingredient in Jason Blum's recipe for success.
Is it disappointing for you, or is it inevitable that a director like James Wan, who did Insidious, Insidious 2, is now doing Fast and Furious 7? In other words, he's almost become so successful through your films that you can no longer afford him, or he's no longer part of your world?
And I'm not saying this because this is an interview. If we were alone in my living room, I'd tell you the same thing. It's a huge joy for me. Before he did Insidious 1, James said, my dream is to do a tentpole movie. And the idea that my little company could help James get a movie that's bigger than every movie I've ever made times 500 is totally gratifying. Does it bother me that James says he's never going to do a horror movie again? Definitely. And am I going to talk him out of that? For sure. And I promise you I'm going to make another horror movie with James Wan, even though he says he's not going to. But the fact that he's doing Fast and Furious now is such a validation of our business, and I love it.
I know on the first Insidious, James Wan really basically worked for free. Now, his ultimate payday was probably a share of the film's back end and the fact that he got to make Fast and Furious now. Is it the same for actors? They're not going to make a lot of money on these films. What is the pitch that you make to actors or department heads when they're making one of these films? They're not going to get maybe their quote. They're maybe not going to have a nice trailer. They're going to work long days. Maybe they're going to work six-day weeks. What is the pitch in terms of why this is a good investment for them to make these kinds of movies?
First of all, they get to sleep at home. Almost all the movies shoot in L.A. We don't travel people, so it's easier to work for less money when you get to say goodnight to your kids. Second of all, the movies are very short. Almost feels like shooting a pilot. They're 4 weeks, so the work schedule is quick. Third, for an actor anyway, when we're talking to actors, the movie's starting in 3 or 4 weeks, so they're not giving up a studio movie to do one of our movies. Again, that's, you know, the difference of being able to be nimble with these movies and less nimble. And then in terms of pay, I'm very proud of the fact that a lot of the people that we've worked with have done extraordinarily well. And the deals are really simple. They're based on what they've made before. So if they have a big quote, we try and get them to their quote. And beyond success, we try and get them past their quote. And that's what we do. The one bumpy ride we have is when someone doesn't have a quote, we don't give them back end. And they say, well, you made Paranormal Activity, so we should participate in your back end when we do a movie with you. That's not how it works. You know, they have to have their success to get their quote. And hopefully, if they don't have a quote and they do one of our movies and it does really well, then they're in a position to get a quote. But that's been a learning experience for representatives, but we've borne through it.
And are you always the person who is saying no to a filmmaker if he wants a little bit more money? I mean, how do you balance the fact that you are producing this movie but also running a company?
I try not to be the person to say no. I try to make that people who work for me, I try and give them that job. But if it gets bad, I try and pass the buck, exactly. But if it gets bad, yeah. But that we don't operate in that way. Like, it has to be raining, so this night on this thing, and we need an extra $20,000 to do it. Well, you know what? It doesn't have to be raining in our movies. Like, we're not chasing a good story at the expense of everything else. And some people will hear that, and it'll make them sick, and they'll say, how can you do that? The story is more important than anything else. Why are you so worried about money? But again, I think when they can't have it rain on the night and Thursday, more often than not, we come up with a solution which is less expensive and better.
How much of the success of these movies lies with the idea as opposed to the execution? I'm going to talk about The Purge, a very kind of catchy idea. I think you call it a sticky idea. What if for one night you could commit as much crime as possible and you wouldn't have to pay any consequences? How much is the idea important to the movie you're going to make as opposed to the execution?
Both equally important, and both are very important. So when we talk to directors and they say, we want to work, you know, a director says, we want to work with you. What are you looking for? I say low budget, high concept. So you have to have a story that can be told relatively inexpensively, which doesn't apply to all stories. And it has to be high concept. It has to be something like, again, like I said before, it doesn't have to get to the Cineplex, but the director and I have to be on the same road to the Cineplex. We may not get there. And the road to the Cineplex is high concept.
High concept meaning something that would be captured in a trailer, on a poster, in a short TV.
Yeah,
ad? How would you define that?
How I define high concept is the head of marketing at any studio would read the script and would say, you know what? You get this 90% right. I know what the trailer is. I know what the poster is. I know what the TV spot. This is a wide release movie. That's how I would define it.
A lot of the movies, Insidious, The Purge, have been very effective through social media. How much attention do you pay to that? Is it possible that you can actually create a social media campaign, or they tend to be much more organic?
Well, just to back up for a second to talk about marketing in the movies, my feeling about marketing these movies, and it's very unusual because the P&A spend on these movies is many, many, many times the budget of the movies. When Insidious works, when The Purge works, when Sinister works, it's 50% the movie and 50% how the movie's released. And I really believe that. So social media is a big part of the marketing of the movies. But like, you know, you talk about The Purge, and The Purge was a very sticky concept, and Universal very, very cleverly wove a campaign together and built a campaign and kind of changed the campaign as they were getting data along the way to a very, very successful release. So I don't know if that really answers your question.
You're at work right now on a slightly Hispanic-leaning version of Paranormal Activity. We should talk a little bit about audience. The Latino audience, huge for genre film. What was the origin of the slightly – I mean, I know it's an English language film with a Hispanic cast. Is that a way to describe Paranormal Activity?
That is. Yeah. So our movies over – they over-index Hispanic, and also everyone thinks it's boys that drive the movie, but it's actually – it's women under 25 is a larger audience for horror movies than boys or men. And so doing the paranormals – that's one of the things that we noticed. We saw that trend, and it's with all our movies, with Sinister, with Insidious. And we batted around ideas of trying to do – where it really came from is I think we thought what would be, you know, a new way to do a Paranormal Activity movie because and kind of really shake it up bigger than Another Family, Another House. And we talked about a bunch of ideas, and one of the ideas was the Hispanic Paranormal Activity, which is the one that we did.
Which is called The Marked Ones.
It's called The Marked Ones. It comes out the beginning of next year, January 2nd or 3rd of next year.
Does the success of these movies actually surprise you? I mean, Insidious ended up doing, I think, more than $42 million in its opening weekend. When you see those numbers and they start to come in on Friday night, what's your reaction to how well these films are doing?
If it feels – it's a great feeling. And it's not a great – it's not a – you know, oh my God, I'm going to buy a boat, but oh my God, the model's working. Because, you know, we did Paranormal Activity and everyone kind of thought it was a magic trick. And then the sequels started to work and everyone said, well, it's an exception. And then when we did Insidious, it's like, well, you did it twice, but, you know, it's very hard to do. And now we've had four unique, different, low budget, high concept, wide release movies, you know, really permeate the culture. And that's a great feeling to try something new and different and see it work. And when you get those grosses on Friday night, that's the message that I get. And there's nothing like it.
Obviously, everybody else has seen those grosses. At what point do you worry about people trying to imitate your model? Do people call you up and say, how do I do this? And are you a little bit reluctant to share some of your secrets?
I've shared them all here. No, we're pretty transparent. And I think there's a lot of room for, you know, low budget movies. The more they make, the more they're good, the more I feel like it helps everyone. You know, and also it takes discipline. I think most successful producers in Hollywood think about low budget movies as how to fill the space between tentpoles. And so we think about them very differently. So that's different. But, you know, I hope a lot of people do these movies. I think it's good for the business.
Thank you, Jason.
Thank you, John. It was a pleasure to be here.
That was Jason Blum in conversation with John Horn of the Los Angeles Times. Blum is the producer of the Paranormal Activity franchise and The Purge. His movie Insidious Chapter 2 is in theaters now. And that's The Business. Darby Maloney produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. You can listen to us anytime on demand with the KCRW smartphone apps. And you can hear the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you download podcasts. The show is produced and distributed by KCRW. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.